Les colloques du Collège de France.
So the next speaker is Duncan Odom. Duncan is at the German Cancer Center in Heidelberg. Duncan, please.
Thank you. Thank you for the kind invitation. It's a real delight to be here. The first three talks were a fantastic set of talks that beautifully show how you can take single loci and deconstruct and reconstruct them to begin unpacking the rules underlying enhancers and enhancer function. And my talk takes a slightly different angle. So what I'm going to do is show you something that came up repeatedly as a side point in many of the talks, and that is the CTCF protein and what function and role it plays. Where did it come from? Where does it go? So the outline of my talk very briefly is that I'm going to blow through the background because I don't need to introduce it because you guys have done a beautiful job doing that. But I will talk to you about the birth, life, and death, the orogeny, homeostasis, and erosion of CTCF binding in mammalian genomes because it's non-trivial. Denis, I added a few slides so you can use your bell. So I took this from an elegant study recently published by our host, which shows, you know, TAD domains and how they operate and how they're bounded by CTCF. But as I said, there's already been a great introduction for that, so I'm just going to go straight through it. My talk is going to be about CTCF protein, which is, I'm not sure if it's been directly mentioned, it's an 11 zinc finger DNA binding protein, which is highly conserved throughout bilatera. It is absolutely essential for mammalian development. So a lot of its function has been described in specific cell types, and you know its depletion and so on, but I'm not sure if these core points had been made. So let's look at what initially brought us to begin asking questions about CTCF. And that curiosity arose from early comparative genomics experiments that my laboratory was doing, where we were taking multiple species worth of matched functional genomics data and asking about the rate of evolution and what the underlying mechanisms were. All right, so for example, this is the APOA2 locus, which is a liver-specific gene, which is required for liver homeostasis. HNF4-alpha and CBP-alpha are tissue-specific transcription factors sitting inside of enhancers, and you can see that this locus is bounded by very strong CTCF flanking it to either side. So our early work reported how the liver-specific transcription factors and later other tissue-specific regulatory networks actually evolve at an incredibly rapid rate, where you can see that the enhancers that control this highly conserved gene and its highly conserved gene expression are in fact highly labile, which was a very big surprise. But the other discovery, which was easily missed in that rush, is that if you look at the CTCF between human, mouse, and dog, not only are the locations conserved, but even the relative enrichment is conserved. Think about that. That is an amazing result. This is an activity in the genome that's conserved for that depth. So the first question that we really started asking is, where do the sequences that both transcription factors and CTCF come from? And I'm not going to tell you too much about the transcription factor side, because that's not what my talk is about today. But I will say that most transcription factors bind really short sequences that just by throwing dice, random chance, genetic drift, they appear in the genome and they can be captured. So they turn over incredibly fast. In contrast, CTCF is a 20 mer. In fact, it can be up to a 33 mer. And that is complex and information rich. And no amount of dice throwing is going to cause that sequence to appear in a mammalian genome randomly. So how did we begin trying to deconstruct this? Where did they come from? They had to come from somewhere, right? So to do this, we did a very simple experiment. We did chromatin immunoprecipitation against CTCF in six species of mammal. I'm showing five here because I wanted to show the placental comparison. And what you'll see is that, I mean, it may not look like there's much conservation because between dog and human, only about a third are conserved. But compared to transcription factors, where it's, you know, 5 to 10%, that's really good. But what this does mean is that you have literally tens of thousands of species-specific CTCF binding events. You do also have tens of thousands that are conserved. And what we did was we took the binding, the bound motifs, and we then began deconstructing them. So when you see something like this, that's not a sequence that CTCF is binding. That's actually a folded average, right? That's where you've taken thousands of these, stacked them, and said, what's the probability rate of specific sequences? And we started by deconstructing the motif usage, okay? And we took each of the words that CTCF bound, and we stacked it in human based on its frequency to infrequent. And what we found was that the frequency of these usages is, in fact, reasonably well conserved. And not only that, there is an extremely strong genetic component to this, where you see that the chip enrichment, as well as the fraction of deeply shared CTCF, is also relatively conserved. Now, this is for most words. We also identified in numerous lineages. So what this means is what I just showed you as actual data. Conceptually, many CTCF words are actually held underneath binding events which are actually shared in terms of their intensity as well as their location, and you also have lots of lineage-specific ones, which I'll come back to. Are you with me so far? Okay. But we found not just conserved words. We looked for words that violated this. We looked for words that were enriched in single lineages. And lo and behold, we were able to find about 90 in mouse, 60 in mouse, 30 in Monodelphus domesticus, which is short-tailed gray opossum, and around 15 to 20 in dog. And when we dug deeper, what we realized was that these were embedded in repeat elements that had expanded in a lineage-specific manner, carrying with it not only the binding motif for CTCF, but the actual binding event across the genome, which we could map very beautifully. So that is what we think the underlying mechanism is. What I'm not showing is some of the deeper analysis that we did, trying to look for residue of that repeat sequence in the conserved ones. In other words, trying to reach back 300 million years instead of 80 million years to look for, as it were, the bones of the repeat element. So we did find evidence of that, but I'm not going to show that today. That suggests that that's actually the mechanism that keeps flushing CTCF into the genome as it erodes. And that's going to be the end of my talk, is how it erodes. All right, so the birth of CTCF binding is maintained at least in part by species-specific sign elements that are carrying the motif around. And this has long been predicted. This is not a huge surprise conceptually, but seeing such a beautiful example where you actually see the expansion to thousands of sites and specific lineages, that was pretty fun. Okay, so I'm now going to present two small little pieces about the genomic anatomy of how CTCF functions. I don't need to dwell on this. One of the features of these TAD junctions is the existence of CTCF. What I'm going to show is how the orientation of CTCF really matters for genome folding and three-dimensional structure. So what we did, again, you might recognize that this is kind of my favorite thing to do, is to do matched experiments in different species. We performed Hi-C in four different species of mammals. We did I'm showing here mouse, dog, and macaque. You can see that these TAD domains are actually very conserved between species. We also characterized what kind of rate that they evolve, that they diverge in. It's important to point one thing out. I forgot to mention this. What we always work with is liver, which is a homeostatic tissue, which is not undergoing differentiation. It's not undergoing any kind of like dynamic reorientations or restructuring. What we're looking at is sort of a steady state. So we're trying to capture matched steady states between species. And that is an important point, because some of the rules that I talk about are just for these specific cases. And some of the dynamics, like what Denis' lab works with, might use slightly different tweaks. Okay, so we did these experiments, and by taking the conserved TAD junctions and crossing that with our previous CTCF binding data that we had already obtained in exactly the same, literally the same samples of the same species, we could actually identify the contact enrichment distances at these points and see that conserved CTCF binding massively enriches for these contact points, indicating that the conserved ones are very closely allied with their functionality in holding the genome pieces, TADs, in place. And in contrast, the species-specific CTCF binding is much more dispensable. And this actually ties into some of the hints that we've seen from that from some of the other talks, where specific CTCF binding events may be completely dispensable for this. Well, not necessarily the TAD ones. Those will eventually erode it, right? But the species-specific ones can be completely dispensable and have no effect on the regional regulation or enhancer activity. Okay. Now, this analysis was done without orienting the sequence that CTCF was bound to. When instead you take the high C data, you burrow down to the junction point, you then take the CTCF motif and you align it as to which direction it's pointing, what you can very quickly see is that the CTCF motif itself actually directs contacts in one direction or another. And that can be revealed by looking at a plus and minus strand where you've actually taken the two orientations. So this paper was one of the first two reports of the orientation of CTCF binding orientation mattering for its function in TAD insulation. And then the final point is, by using closely related mouse species and mapping CTCF at extremely high resolution, one of the things that we're able to do by using closely related mice is to do a base-by-base alignment of the genomic information, which is virtually impossible when you're looking at mouse and dog, for example, because the divergence is so great. When you're looking at closely related mouse species, where it's only one base every 35 or 36 bases that's genetically varied between the two strains, you can actually get really quantitative information about how these regions are evolving. And what we were able to show there is, again, I mean, this repeats what I've shown before, but perhaps at high resolution, that the TAD boundary associated CTCF binding sites are massively enriched for five-way conserved ones. And that those five-way conserved ones are also present with a significant overrepresentation of clusters of much more evolutionarily unstable CTCF binding, which probably serves to buffer that anchorage point. Okay, so what I've shown you so far is a couple of vignettes about how the CTCF binding functions to anchor the genome and its evolutionary stability, and how you can conversely use evolution to try and dissect the underlying mechanisms of the appearance and function of CTCF. Now, the last piece is a completely unpublished piece of work that my lab is just prepping right now, which starts looking at what mechanisms underlie the loss of CTCF naturally. Now, this is work from Stefania Del Prata and Paul Geno, both of whom have been working quite closely on this. So what we did was we created CTCF binding maps in BLAC6 and Castanius mice that are separated by about 1.5 million years of divergence. They have about 20 million SNPs. Now, One aspect of this that's very important to point out is that you can do a lot of replicates. And to do this, we actually did a minimum of 6 replicates in each genetic background and in each F1, including the reverse crosses. And that was to try to get really high resolution on what we were analyzing. The first thing to point out is that we see genotype clustering, which is reassuring, and that the F1 actually shows the same kind of enrichment whenever you are deliberately ignoring the underlying genetic differences. You see that the F1 is an average of the BLAC6 and castaneous parent strains, so that's good. Then what we were able to do is then look at how many of the sites between the two strains were lineage-specific, were species-specific, and as I'll use here slightly loosely. Most are shared, which is good because that's what you would expect for such closely related strains, but we were able to find about 11,000 peaks that were lineage-specific, and we used those to further dissect what was going on. What I'm going to show is a demonstration that the CTCF binding is not affected by trans mechanisms. So in the BLAC6 F1 cast one in the BLAC6 castaneous F1 mice, these two alleles, the BLAC6 allele and the castaneous allele, are in the same nucleus. In contrast, what we did is we created a pseudo F1 where we took the parents' strains and we just computationally folded an equal amount of sequencing reads from the same experiments here, and then we created a scatter plot. And what you can see is that this artificial F1 perfectly recapitulates the native F1, which means that the vast majority of influences here are purely the protein DNA contacts alone, with no outside influence from RNAs or co-binding factors or anything like that. Okay. So we took the binding events and we sorted them based on how tissue specific they were. So as you would imagine, the vast majority of the binding events are going to land right here in the middle where you've got a 50-50 balance split, and indeed they do. But we're able to actually look at the gradation of species specificity in a quantitative way in both directions. And the first thing that we did is ask whether the species-specific regions enriched for genetic variation between the two species, and they do. The other way to look at that is to flip it on its head and to say, does CTCF binding deplete genetic variation? And it does, because those are really the same statement. And when you zoom in, not just on the one kilobase around the binding event, but you actually go to the actual motif that's bound to it, you see it even more dramatically, where you see this this depletion here, where the bound motif in conserved regions strongly selects against genetic variation. Okay, now, this is where it starts getting interesting. What I'm going to do is to start asking what genetic variations are actually occurring in the species-specific binding regions. So, to do that, we've stacked the motif, and then we asked what genetic changes happen between the reference and all of the categories to either side. And you'll notice this here and here. What this represents is overwhelmingly C to T changes in high information content points within the motif. These changes track very, very closely with whether something is lineage specific, and strongly hint that what's going on is some kind of CpG methylation related decay, because what you have is these are changes where you've lost a CpG, which suggests that that might be the underlying mechanism, because one of the things that decays CpGs in all mammalian genomes is the where you actually have, I'm freezing up, deamination of the cytosine. Hey, thank you. Wendy was like, yes, you know it. So you have deamination of cytosine, which then converts it into a TG instead. And that's like in every mammalian genome, that's like the big signal, is there's a huge depletion of CpGs. So we turned to a relatively new technology, which is nanopore deep sequencing, because with nanopore sequencing, you can actually identify the methylation as well as the genetic sequences nearby. And we took these F1 mice, and we beat them pretty hard with nanopore until we had a 10x coverage of over 90% of the CpGs in the genome. And then first couple of sanity checks, what we were able to do is to see that the nanopore deep sequencing recapitulated our understanding of what it should look like, what methylation should look like in an F1. We see a very small number that are not methylated in the genome, and a much larger majority where there's partial or full methylation. This is exactly what you expect from decades worth of work in the field of DNA methylation. And we also are able to recapitulate canonical patterns that are associated with methylation, NCTCF binding. For instance, we can see that at the point of CTCF binding, you see this, when you have very strong CTCF binding, you see this ringing of methylation, which is actually related to histone orientation to either side. And that this also correlates with expression bends. Now, this is the key result that we're still unpacking. Please be aware this is completely unpublished data, so I know it's a little bit rough. I apologize for that. I'm going to give you an example where we take the BLAC6 specific binding of CTCF and then analyze it in the BLAC6 genome as well as the absentee binding in the castaneous genome. And in the castaneous genome, these BLAC6 bound regions look just like you would expect for background. They match very, very closely to what you see in the conserved regions. In contrast with BLAC6, you can see that it tracks with the level of binding. And this strongly suggests that these regions are preloaded to decay because they have a higher methylation rate, but the causality is very difficult to disambiguate. And we're currently trying to do that to some extent by using a third F1 species where we're going out to Spratus and trying to look at the same kind of evolution. So that's an unpublished work. It's not done. I know that the model's still a little rough. I can see Alex is already thinking about it. So the erosion of CTCF binding, what we are starting to really finalize evidence for is that C-to-T deamination may be a major mechanism underlying how CTCF binding motifs erode in multiple lineages. And then I want to give one teaser because Stephen Rong is here with us, and you can follow up with him if you have any further questions, but my lab is also looking at the conservation and divergence of the 3D regulatory genome. And what we've done is collected completely matched capture high-C against where we anchored in over 10,000 promoters in 5 species, and then we did mapping of the enhancer promoter interactions in 3 different tissues. And that is still very much a work in progress, and our analysis continues in that area. These projects that I presented to you represent over 15 years worth of my laboratory's work. I hate to admit that, because that means I'm old. But it's everything started in Cambridge when I was at Cancer Research UK's Cambridge Institute, and that's my team there. And then this is Paul Fleechick's lab and John Marioni and a few of our folks that worked in these projects. More recently, I've been at the DKFZ in Heidelberg, this is a joint lab retreat with a couple of other laboratories, and that's Paul and Stefania who did the lab. I've been collecting and analyzing the data for the erosion project. And so I'm delighted to take any questions, and thank you for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site. Collège-2-France.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.